Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Okay, so the last of the Shlokanusharanam. The foremost of sages, Sri Sukadev Goswami, sat perfectly pacified, intelligent, and ready to answer any question without hesitation. The great devotee Maharaj Parikit approached him, offered his respects by bowing before him, and politely inquired with sweet words and folded hands. The fortunate King Parikit said, "O Brahmana, by your mercy only, you have sanctified us, making us like unto places of pilgrimage, all by your presence here as my guest. By your mercy, we, who are but unworthy royalty, become eligible to serve the devotee. Simply by our remembering you, our houses become instantly sanctified, and what to speak of seeing you, touching you, washing your holy feet, and offering you a seat in our home. O powerful Brahmana, it is said that you hardly stay in the houses of men long enough to milk a cow. Just as the atheist cannot remain in the presence of the personality of Godhead, so also the invulnerable sins of a man are immediately vanquished in your presence. O saint, O great mystic, Lord Krishna, the personality of Godhead, who is very dear to the sons of King Pandu, has accepted me as one of those relatives just to please his great cousins and brothers. Otherwise, without being inspired by Lord Krishna, how is it that you have voluntarily appeared here, though you are moving incognito to the common man and are not visible to us who are on the verge of death? You are the spiritual master of great saints and devotees. I am therefore begging you to show me the way of perfection for all persons, and especially for one who is about to die. Please let me know what a man should hear, chant, remember, and worship, and also what he should not do. Please explain all this to me." Nimisha 12, Srila Prabhupada notes in Purport 37, "Unless one is perfectly anxious to inquire about the way of perfection, there is no necessity of approaching a spiritual master. A spiritual master is not a kind of decoration for a householder. Generally, a fashionable materialist engages a so-called spiritual master without any profit. The pseudo-spiritual master flatters the so-called disciple, and thereby both the master and his ward go to hell without a doubt. Maharaj Parikit is the right type of disciple because he puts forward questions vital to the interest of all men, particularly for the dying men. The question put forward by Maharaj Parikit is the basic principle of the complete thesis of Srimad Bhagavatam. Now let us see how intelligently the great master replies." Sri Suta Goswami tells the sages of Naimisharanya, "The king thus spoke and questioned the sage using sweet language. Then the great and powerful personality, the son of Yas, who knew the principles of religion, began his reply." So you see, this culture, this etiquette is quite important. It's not just an external show. It's not just dry formalities. But there are things that actually invoke very meaningful relationships between people, between devotees. So these kind of interactions and feelings, then these are correct. These are how we should try to look, how we should try to see. Nowadays, we have to be very careful because people want things to be real. So they want to see that nothing can be too nice, too good. There can't be, the ending should be okay. You should have resolved whatever was the problem, the action, the mystery, this and that, but it shouldn't be too nice. Right? They should leave some scope for doubt, some scope for speculation. So the position of duality must remain. You can't clear that. You can't clear, you know, the positive. I mean, you can't create something idyllic. So we have to be careful ourselves that we don't think, oh, that's too idyllic, or that's not possible, or that. So, but then it actually is throwing a shadow of doubt on our faith. Do we really believe that devotional service is the most powerful thing in the cosmic creation? Do we really believe that it has the power to purify anybody? Do we believe that the soul actually is a servant of God, and that's his eternal principle? Or do we think that the material energy has substance, that it actually, activity done here can have a permanent effect? Right? These are questions that come up. Because we see in the Vedas, then Rupa Goswami gives the point, anything that's a drama, then it should be have a proper ending. It has to have a good ending. Generally it takes a conjugal or chivalrous mood, because that will catch everybody's attention. But it must have a good ending. You know, anything too gross or disgusting, you don't see on stage. People don't die on stage. So these kind of things are the way Krishna likes it, because there is no end. They have a pastime and it moves on. There's no such thing as that it ends. But we have to be careful that we're so used to it being like that here in the material world that we project that onto the spirituality. But it doesn't. It still must be a positive outlook. We could say, oh, so many devotees have problems, so many devotees go away. That's if, yes, if you want to look at everything as temporary and miserable and all that. Prabhupada said, you look at it, be impressed who stays. You know, don't be surprised who leaves, be surprised who stays. You know, so in other words, you're looking at the positive thing. It's natural people will fall, but this is what's special. Does that make some sense? So the whole idea is that what he's saying here and doing, this is something that is very much alive even right now. It's not something dead 5,000 years ago or 500 years ago or 100 years ago or okay, it worked in the 60s. This is something that's alive now, and if it's done, of course, one sees time, place, and circumstance, but the same mood and effect everybody will appreciate. Everybody appreciates someone who's respectful, who's humble, who's honest. Right? You know, and this humility is special. He's saying here is that somehow or another I've come in this family of the Pandavas, and therefore the Lord is kind to me because he's kind to, he likes his, the Pandavas, therefore I'm coming in their life, he's nice to me, therefore he must have sent you. He's not saying I'm special, he's saying the Pandavas are special, Krishna's special, Sukadeva Goswami's special. I just somehow or another happened to fall in this family. And I'm also then getting the benefit. So these kind of things, nice inquiry, what to do. He's going to die, so what should I do? Rather than, you know, try to, avoid the topic. You know, okay, we got a week less left, let's go for some extreme sport, you know. It's like, if we die doing the sport, then hey, we're going to die anyway, and if we don't, we'll have a great time.
Bungee jumping.
Yeah, bungee jumping off of an airplane, right? You know, so it's these things. I mean, you know, it's they're crazy. People are crazy.
Yeah, I'd like to make a comment exactly on the same thing Mari's talking about, but it's, I'm turning on a different spotlight, a different direction, but it's on the same subject. Mars was talking about, yeah, this is the, actually in the West it's become quite a style. There's this French word, noir, which means black. And when I was a boy, these films started coming, late 40s, early 50s. And they were known as film noir, very dark films. You'd have a hero, you'd have a heroine. There were these classic films like this one great director, German director, Billy Wilder, yeah. He made a movie in the 40s called Double Indemnity. So you've got a hero played by, who is that guy? Mr. Normal. Remember that old TV show called My Three Sons?
Mm.
And that was that guy, I can't remember his name right now, but he was like Mr. Normal.
Alfred E. Newman?
No. Anyway, he was always playing the very normal type person. And then there was Barbara Stanwyck, this beautiful star of the time. But they get all involved in this complicated relationship, following, you know, their lust and their greed. And it shows, you know, it starts off very innocently, but just following one thread and then another thread, and they just get more and more entangled. And in the end, everybody dies. And they started making, it was after the Second World War, they just started turning out more and more of these kind of very dark, pessimistic films. And this term noir has become so fashionable now. Now you can get noir perfume. You know, women get some kind of perfume that I guess accentuates the femme fatale. That's a term from film noir. Femme, the deadly woman. You see. So it's very fashionable now for women to, you know, present themselves as deadly as possible, like a spider, black spider. You know, what is it?
Black widow.
Spider. You know. And the men are like these cigarette smoking, or Humphrey Bogart, you know, cigarette in the sun, and they don't care, you know. She's a black widow. There's a famous line from Robert Mitchum. He says, "Baby, I don't care." So it's like, you know, this fashion that they're going to just happily going, not happily, actually they're not happy. That's the other thing. They're not happy. They smoke like chimneys. They're nervous. They're, you know, paranoid. They're always, you know, worried about getting shot by someone. There's always 10 people chasing them. But they go on with sense gratification. You see, that's the whole idea. And then at the end, you know, they had some pleasant night in Acapulco. That's from a famous film called Out of the Past. One pleasant night in Acapulco, that's the... And everything else is just horror. <You know? laughs> And so this has become very much the fashion today. And I'm amazed, you know, because I'm older, when I saw, I think in the 80s and 90s, and it's still going on today, young people, they're wearing their hair. They wear their hair in the fashion of the 40s. They dress. That whole mood, the noir mood, the black mood, the total pessimism is very much, they call it Generation X, I guess. You know, the generation that sees no point in life anymore at all. They don't even have this romantic optimism of the hippies. Everything is just dark and pointless. So it's interesting. So as Mara says, we shouldn't bring that baggage with us into spiritual life. You know, it's cynicism. It's cynicism born of sinfulness. Actually being born of too much attachment to sense gratification, not willing to get it up, to give it up, yet at the same time, either subconsciously somewhere or even consciously in the intelligence, one knows this is not good for me. One knows this is not going to turn out to be. I even met, it's amazing, I met a devotee, certainly not going to mention his name, but he was here a while ago. And I did a lot of talking to him because he had read some books I had written and was very fascinated by them. And he was like that. He was telling me the story of his life, and he had some... Anyway, he was interested in some girl who was not a devotee but said she liked Buddhism. and you know, and then he
puts it on the same continent.
He flew off to, I don't know, Paris or Rome to meet her in the middle of, you know, being here in Mayapur. And he just told me at one point, he says, if this girl calls me up, I'm out of here. And I said, why? And he said, you just can't understand. I said, I can't understand. You're mine. You're just totally in mind. Yeah, man, maybe you're right. Yeah, I should think of it from that angle. You know. But they become so much enamored in this. It's a kind of suicidal romanticism, you know. And so this was giving him great trouble in his spiritual life, because this mood was overshadowing him. And then he's trying, you know, he came here to Mayapur and he was expressing all this initial wonderment, you know, oh, I'm here in the Dham and this and that, but gradually these things, you know, like little black demons started to infest his brain.
Noir demons,
black demons. And then he left. He came back, but he definitely wasn't in the same shape he was before he left. So what Maharaj is talking about is a very real thing, because sense gratification is a drug. Prabhupada actually once said back in the, you know, way back when he was talking to people, preaching to persons who used to ask him, have you taken LSD, Swamiji? Prabhupada actually said, LSD is simply a spice, a little spice in the real drug, which is Maya. So this is the most powerful addictive drug there is. And so Krishna consciousness is meant to purge it from our system. So anyway, I've said all that, and all I've done is just said what Maharaj said in different words. Now I want to actually come to the other point of, you know, the other aspect or way of looking at the same subject. Because there's a kind of another way of doing the same thing, but it seems optimistic. It's setting yourself up for a fall by, I think a few days ago I mentioned how someone asked me, because I was telling him about our Bhagavatam class, and you know, the intention is to go into a very deep study, and we're not concerned so much with time, you know, how long it will take us to finish a canto. We don't have a schedule like that. Bhakti Vaibhava course in 6 months, 1 month per canto, that's not a concern. You know, that's fine. That's a fine program of education, but it's not what we want to do, because Bhagavatam is promising something to us. But Bhagavatam says Nityam Bhagavata Sevya. It doesn't say 6 months, get a degree, and then you get what the Bhagavatam is. It doesn't say that at all. It says if you want what the treasure that the Bhagavatam has to offer, then you have to be prepared to become an eternal servant of the message of the Bhagavatam. And that means, as Prabhupada would say, reading these scriptures and seeing them from different angles, different lights, always seeing something new in them, ever fresh, nava-nava-rasa. So this is what we have to cultivate, and that is a science. I was thinking when Maharaj was talking about persons who go away, you know, come for a time and then they go away, forgetting the spiritual. It came to mind this verse spoken in the first canto that we've already studied by Narayana Muni, in which he uses this term rasagraha, which is actually stating that anyone who's not, you know, a hati mata offender, anyone less than that, who becomes attracted to Krishna consciousness, you know, they like the prasad, they like the kirtan, they like the devotees, they may go away, but they're sure to come back, because they're rasa grahis. They have actually attained some level or other of rasa by that attraction. In other words, that attraction in their life became strong enough to pull them out. There's these very intellectual books they write about noir films, and they always talk about. I read in one book, the author actually used the term the web of Maya. Actually used the term. He said these films depict the world as the web of Maya. So it's quite an interesting art form. And the thing is that people are sailing into the web of Maya with big smiles on their faces and cigarettes hanging down on the side. They want to be in that web. But that person, that rare person who goes to a Sunday feast and, you know, hears a lecture and joins in kirtan, takes a book and becomes... I mean, already they're pulled out of the web of mind. Right there. Already they're rasagraha. Right there. And if they come again the next Sunday, and then the next Sunday, and gradually they enter the bhakti program and, you know, become devotees for a year, for 2 years, for 5 years, and then they leave, and you don't see... I saw a godbrother of mine I haven't seen in 20 years. And he kind of, in a rueful way, said, "I've been out of circulation for 20 years. And I said, "Yeah." I said, "You do seem familiar to me. I just couldn't place." He said, "Yeah, well, you haven't seen me for 20 years. In the meantime, I did grow a beard." You know? But he was on his way back to Krishna consciousness. And that's just what Narada Muni says. That those who attain this rasa, as long as they don't commit the mad elephant offense, corporeal offense against Vaishnava, that taste is going to bring them back. And that's why Prabhupada mentions the nectar of devotion, that devotees who are fixed up, who actually, you know, who come and stay, they may go through different problems. I mean, we all do. We all go through different periods we all have our ups and downs in spiritual life. But more or less they're staying in the Krishna consciousness movement. And Prabhupada says they have already performed devotional service for many lifetimes before, because that rasa has become so strong for them, they can't give it up. They can't let go of it. You know, the femme fatale may be beckoning, "Come and meet me at the Piazza del Sol in Rome, where the pigeons are pooping all over the place, and we'll kiss and we'll hear violins." And so he may be, you know, drawn to that, but if he doesn't go, you know, he doesn't go, no, this is Maya, that means that he's really attained that rasa. And this is a science of rasa. It's called the rasa tattva. This Krishna consciousness is a science of rasa, and particularly Rupa Goswami is the most outstanding scientist. So this science is teaching us how to cultivate that rasa up to the point of entering into the real love affair, which will not end as a noir tragedy, which was actually Maharaj was, he didn't say it openly, but when he mentioned the drama in Rupa Goswami, you know, the plays of Radha and Krishna always, when they, you know, there's that term, "And they lived happily ever after. It's only true
for that."
And the Jwaladilamali and plays like that. Yeah. In the material world, it's never true.
Yeah.
You see. So Rupa Goswami is actually teaching us how to come up to that, I hate to use the word ideal because it makes it sound like some mental construct, but it is the reality, the actual reality of our spiritual life, to realize it in full. But I'm going to wind this up, but the real point I want to focus on is that this is a science. So there's no free ride. There's no free ride. And this I think, is a big obstacle, if I may speak you'll allow me to speak editorially for. Am I allowed to speak editorially here? As long as I don't name names. Okay, I won't.
As long as the names have been changed.
I try not to do that. I won't name names or point fingers, but speaking editorially, you know, if we go this other way, this naive optimism, which is not what Marge was talking about, you know, bright-eyed, you know, and, oh, as soon as I saw him, I knew he was my guru. And, you know, and I took shelter and this and that. You know, that's fine, that emotionalism. That's very fine. That's part of devotional service. But if we don't go beyond that, if we don't go beyond the initial sentiment, which is actually drops of mercy given to us by Lord Chaitanya just to get us out of that web of Maya, so the black widow spider doesn't suck all the juices out of us so that spiritual life becomes impossible. I mean, you've seen, if you really want to see people who just, you know, spiritual life is impossible, go to a library and get one of those old books from the 40s of the film stars, these old black and white publicity photos of people like Humphrey Bogart and Robert Mitchum and Marilyn Monroe and Rita Hayworth. Take a good look at their faces. These are people who had just had, they had no chance. They had no chance. It was just their misfortune that they took a human birth. They had no chance to meet Guru. The spider web of, you know, the spider of Maya just sucked everything good that might have been in them out of them before they, you know, before the time of death. And they're in some very dark place now, some very noir place now.
Seriously, noir.
You know, these are people who are just convinced, they're just totally convinced that life is meant for sense gratification. That's all. And the opposite side is, you know, is this New Age idea that, you know, everything is spiritual, everything is wonderful, and you know, you just have to keep seeing the positives. But no, we do distinguish between Krishna and Maya, and that is discrimination, and discrimination is intelligence, and intelligence must be sharpened, and we have to keep sharpening that intelligence every day, otherwise it will become dull. And that's why even a person who's been in devotional service 20 years or 25 years can fall into Maya and go away if they fail to do that, if they fail to keep sharpening the blade of the intelligence so that they can discriminate between what is Krishna and what is Maya on a day-to-day basis. Because especially when you start to get into these more subtle regions of, you know, intelligence, then Maya similarly becomes very, very subtle. It's actually called in the Shastra Daivi Maya. It's the personal Maya of Lord Vishnu. It's his own personal energy. This is the Maya by which he keeps all the demigods. They're all, they're devotees, but like Mara said the other day, they're neophytes. So you can read in the Srimad Bhagavatam about the demigods. They have their wild love affairs and their scandals and
prestigious.
I wonder if they have a tabloid magazine in Svargaloka.
I think they're called Gandharvas.
Gandharvas. Okay. And the Gandharvas spread the news that someone has fallen down and some scandal has happened. Mm-hmm. And that's going on, even among the demigods and their devotees, you see. But what's the problem? What's the difficulty? Is that the intelligence is just not sharp enough. You see, they cannot separate that pleasure of the senses from the pleasure of rasa, which is what the rasa tattva is all about. The rasa graha, one who is rasa grahi, Narada Muni says, he will always come back to Krishna consciousness. That's an example in the heavenly planets. The demigods there have come back to Krishna. They're there to serve Krishna. Prabhupada says that's what they're there for. They do their duty, then they do their duty very nicely, but it's just that in their minds, in their hearts, there's other things still going on that sometimes creates disturbance for them or even for the whole. Sometimes, and that's why the demons sometimes become powerful and can even take over the whole Devaloka. And they have to go flying off in the form of pigeons or something. You know, hide in that square in Rome where the lovers are meeting. So the demons won't find them. So in other words, we can make a lot of trouble for ourselves if we don't take this seriously as a science. And that's why, to get back to a point I started to make a few minutes ago, that's why when someone asked me a few days ago, I was telling them, you know, they were asking me what I'm doing, and so I told them about this class, working on these study guides, and our purpose is to, we want to have a class that will hopefully help the devotees actually have some experience of what the Bhagavatam is promising to give us, experience of Krishna. And not just 45 minutes of information. And by saying that, that's an editorial. I don't mean to put anyone down. Please don't take it that way. But sometimes classes are like that. They're just 45 minutes of information that you could have heard off of, you know, tape recorded Prabhupada's class. So there are actually some devotees, when they prepare for class, they just listen to a tape of Srila Prabhupada and they repeat. That's all right. That's all right. But why do we like the Bhagavatam is spoken by Shukadeva Goswami? Because by the touch of his mouth, it became even sweeter. Because he added realization. And that's how the Bhagavatam increases. And Prabhupada said in the higher planets, there are millions and millions of cantos of Bhagavatam. Because this nectar, this is Krishna. So there's no end to the nectar. So you can't reduce it down to some dry formulas that you can memorize. You know, some list of, I've heard the term being circulated around in ISKCON, PowerPoints. Some list of PowerPoints that you memorize and you've got it down, the Bhagavad philosophy, you know. You just repeat. That might be good for, you know, Joe Schmo standing on the street, you know, doesn't know anything. But as we get older in Krishna consciousness, we're going to feel ourselves bereft if we just stick with the tired formulas that we learned 20 years before. And that's why devotees leave. So anyway, this devotee, when he heard me giving I just tried to give an overview, and his jaw kind of dropped open, and he said, but didn't Prabhupada say that Krishna consciousness is simple for the simple? I mean, if you're simple, then isn't everything just simple? And I told him, I think you need to go to the dictionary and find out the difference between the word simple and the word stupid. Because simple, like in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Sharalata, it actually means, and Maharaj used the word, honest. It actually means straightforward. It means simple in that way. You know, his mind is not a devil's workshop. I'll never forget, an old friend of mine in Krishna consciousness, he had this joke. It was a rather cynical joke, actually. Right? You shouldn't talk like this about devotees, but you know, there are always anyone who's been years in ISKCON knows that there are some devotees, you know, who live in the temple, and it's very good fortune that they're somehow able to stay in the temple, but they're known to be a bit off, you know, a bit weird, a bit not really in Krishna consciousness, but somehow, you know, purely, but somehow they're able to stay. And they're not generally engaged in regular activities. They're, you know, they have special services like fixing the sankirtan bands, or, you know, and they like to do that 24 hours a day. And sometimes, you know, once a year or so, you might see one of these odd type of devotees who you never think are very Krishna conscious. They're sitting down and they're reading the Bhagavatam. They never come to class, but there they are reading the Bhagavatam. So one friend of mine, who I haven't seen for many years, so anyway, but he had a very sharp, sarcastic kind of humor. And we were once walking through the Brahmachari Ashram. We saw such a devotee reading one of Prabhupada's books, and it was surprising. And I turned to this friend and I said, "Wow, did you see that?" And he looked at me and said, "He's just looking for loopholes." I don't know if you know what that means. Looking for loopholes. It's like you read a law book, but you're looking for ways to, you know, get through without having to follow the law. You know, some. You know, people sometimes do that. They study the law so that they can find a way to break the law without actually breaking the law, because writers of the law have left a loophole. It means they've left something out. And there are people who become very expert, you know, and there's crooked lawyers who are experts in this. And you go to, like, tax lawyers, you know. Rich people go to tax lawyers, and I don't want to pay any tax. You know, I earned $5 million this year, but I don't feel like paying one penny of tax. All right, let's sit down and figure out how to do this. And they get out all these books and they can find out ways how you don't have to pay a penny in tax, although you should pay so much. So, that's certainly not how we should be approaching the scriptures, looking for loopholes. It's a great science. And we need to approach it as seriously. I know if anybody, some of you maybe took science classes, was serious about some classes when you went to school, not necessarily science, history, literature, I don't know what. I mean, generally, devotees do tend to come from more intelligent background. So, we need to sometimes reflect on how serious we were about some subject when we were 14 years old. And, you know, unless you're a Gurukul, if you're a Gurukul student, you should be serious about every subject. But in Karmi schools, generally, we're serious about some subjects and others. We wish we could just put dynamite under the classroom and blow it up. But,
like lunch break or something.
Those subjects that we were serious about for some time in our life, you know, we really thought we would dedicate it. We have to be serious like that about this subject matter, and not just temporarily. So the seriousness has to increase so that the rasa will increase. And the rasa will increase as our discrimination increases. You see? And Prabhupada said, you know, when devotees would ask him, sometimes devotees would ask Prabhupada so many questions, he would finally put a stop to it by saying, if you have discrimination, if Krishna gives you discrimination, then you will know all the answers to these questions. You know, these technical questions like, how long should we, you know, keep the spices for the chants on the fire, you know, and, or all these different kinds of questions, you know. So there were sometimes times when Prabhupada would be barraged by such questions, and he would finally say, he might sometimes say, all these questions can be answered if you simply have discrimination. And to have discrimination requires realization. Discrimination means realization. And conversely, realization means discrimination. So, this is, especially now as we get into the second canto, this really becomes the razor sharp issue, the issue of discrimination. Because this is what Bhagavatam is first doing, is cutting us free of gross maya. And the work of that really begins in the second canto. So we're, we'll let Maharaj take you closer. to that second canto ever, so far ever on the horizon. We want to finally get there.
It's coming. Only a few more pages.
One thing that struck me in that this about the, because it means first presentation was that you have the optimist and you have the person who's not, and the optimist is romantic and the pessimist is not, but actually then Maharaj's presentation, then you got the idea that actually the pessimist is also very romantic about his pessimism, that everything can be bad, everything, you know, will go wrong, you know, and then they can take satisfaction in knowing that it's all bad and all this, and there's
yeah,
a taste.
They even write songs about that, love yeah. song, you know, yeah. that's love.
Yeah, yeah,
getting kicked in the face by the Shias, that's love.
Yeah. 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 Maybe we should start write a few songs, make some money on the side. Washboard, gut bucket. Right? So it's actually it's. I think you have a philosophy of that, isn't that what existentialism is?
Yeah, the atheistic existentialism is very much about that.
Yeah, so it's like they're actually romantic about the idea that everything can be bad and it's going to perfectly be timed to work out badly at all the right times. You know? It'll all work out perfectly bad. And then they can be satisfied in being pessimistic and tasting that, and it's all, and I was, you know, right, or I was foolish, or, you know, whatever it is, they can justify
it's,
all
it's,
of their...
It's being tough, actually. Mm. It's like Murari Gupta's tomcat, Emmanuel. He goes out every night. He comes back with claw marks across his face. Because, you know, to get sex, these tomcats have to fight with sometimes three or four other tomcats at once. Mm-hmm. So he comes back with claw marks across his face, sometimes the whole side of his head is swollen up. But he comes swaggering in, you know, in the morning. I'm a tough guy. That's what it is.
Real stoic. Okay.
Nothing will stop me in my sense gratification.
Yeah. So you just have to be careful that we don't fall. I mean, both are a trap. One is that being so idyllic and not being intelligent, not using discrimination, or using the discrimination without seemingly having any positiveness. Because the soul is based on ananda and eternity. So whatever we do, it will have the underlying flavor, eternality, and something that's going to give us happiness, whether it's positive or negative. So then we just have to see is that it's a balance, that we have that optimism, but it's directed at Krishna, it's positive. But at the same time, we discriminate and we know the world is bad, but we know that Krishna consciousness is real, it's more powerful. So the one will gradually predominate. The Krishna consciousness will predominate. Okay.
Yeah, and it's important to note that Bhagavatam, when I say science, these nine cantos, especially up to the tenth canto, the tenth canto is the summum bonum. Mm-hmm. So that's where the nectar is flowing. But the nine cantos up to there are so extremely, I mean, it's the greatest science of all. Mm-hmm. You want psychology? Mm-hmm. There it is. I mean, it is laid out in such a way to take you through every dark nook and cranny of human psychology there is. Mm. And illuminate it and show you what's really going on. Mm. There is nothing that's... You know, that's why I don't understand... This editorially speaking again. I cannot understand why, you know, devotees get so fascinated about Western psychology. But these Western psychologies, I like to use a dirty word, a four-letter word beginning with an S and ending with T, but I can't. They don't know blank. And I've talked to persons who have degrees, MA degrees in Western psychology, and they've admitted as much. So, you know, we psychologists, we all have our different schools, but you know, the total picture, we don't know. There's 6 to 8 different schools of psychology. But now psychology has become so strong in ISKCON that it's been written into some GBC resolutions. That's a real editorial statement. And I don't understand it. I tell you, I do not understand. No one's ever going to be able to explain it to me. I think it's insanity. But anyway, I'm using my freedom of speech here. We're all very democratic now in ISKCON, so I'm exercising my freedom of speech and saying I think it's insanity. And I think especially those people who write such kind of resolutions need to study the Srimad Bhagavatam very, very carefully. Especially the first 9 cantos. How about that? Okay, I'll stop before the thought police come and get me off.
Okay, so continuing on from where his editorialness left off. Okay, question 9.3. Question 26 of Srimad Bhagavatam is asked by King Parikshit of the sages gathered on the bank of the Ganges. He placed his question before them just prior to Sukadeva Goswami's arrival on the scene. Question 26. Please, after proper deliberation, tell me of the unalloyed duty of everyone in all circumstances. Nimisha 13. The above question asked by Maharaj Parikshit is the first of 2 distinct inquiries voiced by him in verse 24, as is made evident in the purport to the verse. In this verse, the king has placed 2 questions before the learned sages. The first question is, what is the duty of everyone in all circumstances? And the second question is, what is the specific duty of one who is to die very shortly? Out of the 2, the question relating to the dying man is most important, because everyone is a dying man, either very shortly or after 100 years. The duration of life is immaterial, but the duty of a dying man is very important. Maharaj Parikshit placed these 2 questions before Sukadeva Goswami, also on his arrival, and practically the whole of the Srimad Bhagavatam, beginning from the 2nd canto up to the last 12th canto, deals with these 2 questions. The conclusion arrived at, therefore, is that devotional service of the Lord Sri Krishna, as it is confirmed by the Lord himself in the last phases of the Bhagavad Gita, is the last word in relation to everyone's permanent duty in life. Maharaj Parikshit was already aware of this fact, but he wanted the great sages assembled there to unanimously give their verdict on this conviction, so he might be able to go on with his confirmed duty without controversy. He has especially mentioned the word shuddha, or perfectly correct. For transcendental realization or self-realization, many processes are recommended by various classes of philosophers. Some of them are first-class methods, and some of them are second- or third-class methods. The first-class method demands that one give up all other methods and surrender unto the lotus feet of the Lord, and thus be saved from all sins and their reactions. What's interesting is here is this connection here, this is on relation to everyone's permanent duty. Is the last, okay, confirmed by last phases, where surrendering to him. So we see here there's a connection between, this is very important, is that relationship and duty basically are synonymous. Right? Because if you have a relationship, means you have duties that you are performing towards each other. And if you have duties, that means there must be a duty towards someone. Does that make some sense? So, performance of the duty, that's abhideya. But that you have a duty, and the directives of that duty, and directives of that relationship, that's sambandha. So, here being brought out is the Lord. The Lord is the basically the last word
in what is duty, what's relationship, that we have a eternal relationship with Him. He is existence. And so our existence is in connection with Him. So does that make some sense?
So this thing of what is the duty, then is being brought out here, that duty then is connecting ourselves with the Lord. Because everything he's going to explain in the Bhagavatam is how to extract oneself from the so-called mundane relationships, and through Krishnaizing that, bring it to the point of actually reestablishing one's eternal relationship with Krishna. That's first class. These other things are second, third class. But if they're connected to Krishna, then they also become first class. Right? So karma and jnana are, you know, second, third class, but if they're connected to Krishna, then they also function like first class. But within first class, then there's also, you know, first class, second first class, third first class. It means chanting Hare Krishna, hearing Bhagavatam, serving the devotees. This is first class. It's directly spiritual.
That's what probably explains Buddha Yoga.
Oh, okay.
That karma yoga, when it is engaged in Krishna's service, is a form of Buddha yoga. In other words, your karma has been illuminated by Krishna Buddha, the Lord's direction from within. And then when it's knowledge, when your knowledge becomes in line with the teachings of the Lord, then that's Buddha yoga in terms of jnana. But when you just chant Hare Krishna and be a devotee and serve Krishna to please Him, to satisfy Him, and that's the object of your life, then Prabhupada, this is in Renunciation Through Wisdom, I believe he writes that then Buddha Yoga has become perfect. That's the perfection of Buddha Yoga.
That's real intelligence.
Yeah.
Okay.
But like you said, all three, because Bhagavad Gita is very much about Buddha Yoga. The Lord uses that term so many times. So, and he's actually, that's the whole point, the teaching, telling Arjuna to fight. Use your intelligence for me. That's Buddha Yoga.
You get this. In other words, it's a simple point, but it's, you know, we tend to be a bit stubborn on this one, but is that, that's the one thing. You have so many sages there, and when Sukadeva Goswami starts speaking, you don't hear of anybody leaving. You don't hear of anybody not being interested. And Parikshit Maharaj is worried that there wouldn't be a consensus. So now all these different paths, you know, one can say this is what you should do, that's what you should do, so many things, this is good, that's bad. But actually the real conclusion, or the thing that creates that consensus, is that connecting it to Krishna. Because no matter what the path, that path is in the proper way, according to the acharyas, connected to Krishna, then, as Maharaj pointed out, it becomes Buddha Yoga. That's the beauty of it. It's karma, and it's incomplete. In other words, you take devotional service. The living entity serves Krishna eternally in the spiritual realm. Those activities, the activity itself, that's karma. Using their intelligence, how to do things, and understanding what is all the particular elements of rasa there, they'd be using their intelligence. But we see is that karma comes into the material world in the reflection, but Krishna being taken out of it, it has the form, but it's not complete. So then to fill in that completeness, so I mean, in other words, those devotees are doing it out of a sense of attraction, a bhav, a need. But in karma, in the material world, that activity is not being done for God. So it's incomplete. So you have to make it complete by creating a bhav, creating a determination, a need. So therefore, the enjoyment of the heavenly planets, or enjoyment of wealth, prestige, and whatever it is you want, then becomes the driving, the bhav. So it actually becomes spontaneous. The karma is spontaneous. He wants to do this. He follows the rules, but he wants to do that. The jnani, his system is incomplete, being on the transcendental platform, but it's created a sense of, you know, I am God, or I'm free from the material world, or... Does that make some sense? So they have to... So Krishna consciousness simply means returning the motive for your action or your intelligence or your affection is Krishna. Does that make some sense? So all you're doing is taking whatever the system is there, because it's originally a devotional system, but because it's reflected in the material world, the materialist isn't interested in it, doing it for Krishna. So he has to, the only way you'll do something if there's a prayojana. And if there's a need, then there'll be activity. So then that prayojana is changed to attract the materialist. So then all we have to do is change that prayojana back, and then the thing becomes transcendental. It's actually that simple. Problem is we're not necessarily convinced. That's why, as Maharaj is pointing out, it's scientific. It deals with everyone, as we were going through chapter by chapter, because they were so short, you could see them one after another. And you could see is that the concept that somebody else other than me is God, and that's okay, that I will be protected, I will be happy. You know, that the element of that there is sadness or loss is not bad if it's connected to the eternal, because the eternal is always there. It's just another flavor that enhances being together. So all these different things that are there that would be a problem for accepting pure Krishna consciousness is taken care of. These chapters taking care of something, bringing out something, establishing something, to remove all the doubts and misgivings that are there. So this process then, meaning that it's just everything's reconciled if Krishna is put in the center of it. And this isn't just, we're just saying that, it's not sentiment, it's a science. Is that the goal of this is Krishna. The relationship here is between myself and Krishna and his material energy that we're engaging in his service. Right? Then everything becomes perfect. Then the jnanis, the yogis, the karmis, everybody's satisfied, because their process still works, but now it will take them to Krishna. It's just different aspects than of buddhi yoga, as opposed to being something very separate. So it's that's all it is. It's a reflection. Just go back to the original. Then it's real. That's what's nice about it. Here the reflection's always the reflection. But because it's Krishna's energy, it's reflected on the water of the material world, meaning on the illusion of what we perceive it as. Because everything here is real, but what we perceive it as is unreal. So if we then see it for what it is, then it will give us the same devotional results as the spiritual, because it is spiritual. It's only on our perception that we're God, we're the controller, we're the enjoyer, which is those two that I'm talking about. We're the controller means your relationship is off, your duty is off. And, you know, instead of me serving God, I'm trying to be God. So we've reversed roles here. And my goal is to please Krishna rather than to please myself. Then the Abhideya will be correct. So then it doesn't matter what the Abhideya is. Right? Whether you're performing an activity, whether it's using your intelligence, whether it's the emotion, it doesn't matter, because it's all perfectly engaged in Krishna's service. Does this make any sense? Yeah. So then we'll end here, and then we'll continue on Monday with question 27. Yeah, we're getting basically to the end here. Okay. Jai Ho. Gantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivarinda ki, Jainitai Gaura Premanandi.